Hola, so. Back to mindfulness of breathing. A number of you, at least a half dozen or so, have commented that when practicing mindfulness of breathing and some of the other practices also, like settling the mind, that a lot of energy comes to the head. This is generally, if not always, a result of, what's that? Trying too hard. There could be biological, there could be other factors involved. It's not out of the question. But especially when settling the mind, where it tends to be kind of up here for many people, that is up in the area of the head, the mindfulness of breathing at the nostrils, obviously we are focusing on sensations in the head. And if we do so with too much intensity, then the prana goes where the attention is, and if the attention is really kind of fierce, strong, insistent, determined, then the big, how do you say, coarse prana, I'm speaking somewhat poetically here, but some coarse prana, some just strong, heavy prana, congeals in the head. And that can be distracting, and in worst case, it can, well, I don't know about worst case, but a worse, if not worst case, is that it can start giving rise to not only energy, but pressure, not only pressure, but headaches, not only headaches, but really severe headaches. And we just don't need to go there at all. So should you find that pressure starts to build up in the head, then what I would suggest is come back down to the abdomen, or full body awareness. All of this will be good. At the same time, this is a practice that has been followed for many, many centuries to great effect, and so it shouldn't be something that we always have to steer clear of or avoid because we think, oh no, that'll give rise to pressure in the head. And so, just a reminder here, and that is when we do bring the attention to the sensations there at the nostrils, it's a very slender type of attention. It's like putting your little baby finger on it rather than your fist. Okay? It's a light touch. It's almost as if you're looking at it through a straw, you know? And moreover, and I just re-emphasize this again and again, keep your eyes totally disengaged from the meditative practice. It is absolutely not a visual practice. Now there's another thing, also now that we're approaching the last week of the retreat, it's very, very easy to feel, I should have made more progress by now. Out of 9 stages, I would think at least 4 or 5. I'm American. We get things done. And so it's easy to be frustrated. It's easy to have false expectations. The 9 stages and all the descriptions around them are precisely designed so that we don't have false expectations, that we're on when we are on the early phases of the practice, that we don't expect to be much, much further, that we're happy to be where we are. So I'm going to give a bit of instruction here that's very, very much along the lines of your glasses half empty or your glasses half full. So your glasses half empty, when you are practicing mindfulness of breathing, and after a little while, a second or two, your attention is strayed. And you say, shucks! And you bring it back. And then a few seconds later, shucks! And shucks! And it basically becomes your mantra, the shucks mantra. You can have a more, how do you say, poignant mantra if you like. But shucks, I think, pretty well. It rhymes with sucks, so that helps. So that's one way of approaching it. That's the glasses half empty approach, is I am a loser. I am a loser. I'm no good. I really suck. Shucks. That's one kind of little mantra sequence you can try. The other one, though, relates back to the point about the beginning of samsara in the conversation with Elizabeth yesterday. And that is, these are little micro samsaras, right? When we just get caught up, carried away, we're in a little tiny micro samsara as we're wandering around, unknowing and deluded. Unknowing, we don't know we're wandering. Deluded, we think what we're thinking about is reality. It's not, it's just appearances to the mind, right? But if that's samsara, if that's a little miniature, a little, you know, a little parallel to samsara, then waking up, that is recognizing that you were distracted and you no longer are for a little while, that must be a little tiny micro nirvana. So instead of going shucks, shucks, shucks every time you find yourself having fallen in some samsara, in fact, you should be saying just the opposite, because you should be saying shucks while you're in samsara, not after you've escaped. Right? Likewise for a lucid dream. When you suddenly become lucid, you don't say, shucks, I used to be unlucid. You say, yippee, I'm lucid. Right? Right? Yes, good. Elizabeth, when it is a muddy. So when you find that your mind has wandered, well, you know it's no longer wandered, so that's exactly the time to go yippee. Yippee or yippee-yay kaye, with no addition. That's the time to be happy. That's the glass half full. And that is, by the time you've recognized you're no longer distracted, you've just found a little glimpse of being real. And that is being in the present, being clear, and savor it. And here's the real point, and then we're going to jump in. Take satisfaction in it. It's very easy to feel, gosh, I bet stage 3 must be a lot better. Stage 7, I've heard about stage 7. It sounds really, really good. I wish I could be in stage 7. Oh, heck, I wish. Shishamata. Geez, how long is it going to take? Do I have it? Do I have what it takes? And so you can go into wishful thinking, then into uncertainty, and then into frustration about who you actually are, and all of that. So there's one avenue. And the other one is just to, when you do come back, nice to be home again. Nice to be real. Nice to be clear. Nice to be at ease, still, and vivid, even if it's just for a few seconds in duration. This is good. And I'll probably lose it, but I'm going to come back again. And I'm going to see if I can be as sane as possible for as long as possible in more and more frequent intervals. And this is the way to go. So I'll end with a little story. When I was very early days in Dharamsala, there was no generation above us of Western Dharma practitioners, you know, who were 10, 20 years, who'd been there for 10 or 20 years earlier, and they'd been practicing a long time, and they could coach us through. There just weren't any. Mervyn and I were the first generation. Bob Thurman had dropped in for a year and a half or two, but he was gone. We never saw him there. And that was it. I mean, our generation was the first one, those who showed up in the very end of the 60s, the early 70s. And so there we were. But there was this one fellow, he's a Englishman, but lived in America, and then he came out to India. And he'd been practicing. What he'd been practicing, he'd been practicing for some time. And he was coming to me for getting some teaching of the tradition. So I would give him some teaching. He was much older than I. But I could speak Tibetan and that kind of thing. So on one occasion, we're sitting around, and he said, Alan, tell me, what is it? What is it about Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism that draws you? Why are you practicing it? What's the hook? And I thought, okay, yeah, I can do this. And I started to give him a little mini discourse on the three principles of the path: renunciation, bodhicitta, view of emptiness. And I thought, this is good. This is good. And so I started giving my little mini Dharma. He said, no. I don't mean that. Why are you practicing Dharma? I thought, I was just starting to give a really good talk there. You cut me right off. Okay, you don't like that talk, okay? I started another one, Four Noble Truths. This will be good. This is really good. And I started my little Four Noble Truths talk. And he said, no, that's not what I mean, Alan. Why are you practicing Dharma? Look, I was about to give you two of my best Dharma talks, and you didn't want either one of them. So I said, so what? What is it you're looking for? And he answered this question, and he answered it sagaciously, that is, with wisdom. He said, you know why you're practicing Dharma? Because there's nothing else to do. And it was not pejorative. I know him. He was not putting me down like some stupid hippie who couldn't figure out anything else to do. That it was true. That there just wasn't anything else apart from Dharma. And so I was pretty much willing to make any sacrifice. Not because I was so sacrificial or so had such a, you know, something special. It's just that there wasn't anything else that had any appeal, any promise. There wasn't anything else to do. When you've tried out everything else and it shows no promise, there's only one thing standing, and that's Dharma. So it kind of gets simple when you get to that point. Whether you're gifted or not gifted. I'm not very gifted. I'm not very gifted, frankly. I'm kind of smart, but I'm not very gifted for Dharma. Slow, really slow. That's true. You might think I'm being humble, but I'm not. I'm just being straight. But whether you're gifted or you're not gifted, if this is the only thing to do, then you just do it. And however long it takes, we say, but this is the only thing to do. Everything else is clearly a washout. Nothing else has any promise of giving genuine happiness. And this has promise. This is real. And so we go here. So that's my sense of it. When you get to the point where there's just nothing besides Dharma to do, life becomes very simple. Okay? So let's have a session. Let's settle the body, speech, and mind in their natural state. For a little while, rest your awareness in the earth element. The sensations of firmness and solidity where your body is in contact with the ground. Place to rest. A constant. Relaxing deeply with every out-breath, all the way through the end. Releasing thoughts as you breathe out. and elevate the focus of attention to the sensations of the breath at the apertures of the nostrils or just above the upper lip. Focus a bit more closely as you breathe in. Focus with a deepening sense of relaxation as you breathe out. And to the best of your ability, sustain the flow of your attention there, on your target, both during and in between the breaths, so that you can attend to the whole body of the breath, the whole course of the in and out breath. Occasionally, just slightly lift the eyebrows to create a softness and openness around the eyes. To counteract any tendency of visually looking downwards, visually focusing on the tip of the nose. Keep a spaciousness in the forehead. Let your mindset be like that of lying on a beach in the warm sun, watching the waves flow up on shore, flow back into the sea, with no desire, no expectation, just enjoying being in the present, attending to this rhythmic flow in and out. Count the breaths insofar as you find that helpful, and apply introspection, monitoring the flow of attention, relaxing every time you see the mind has been caught up and carried away by excitation, and gently arousing and focusing your attention every time you see you slip into dullness. Let's continue practicing now in silence. bring the session to a close. Also, just as a reminder, something I commented several weeks ago, and that is that this practice of mindfulness of breathing, it's really in drug rehabilitation, I think it's called cold turkey, and that is we want something to entertain us. That's why, I mean, if one looked for a reason, although there's no real reason, it's just habit, but while the mind chatters on and on and on and on, entertainment value. Even though it's like going to an infomercial and watching repeats on an infomercial. You might prefer that over just snow, you know, just a screen that just goes, give me the infomercial, just one more infomercial, just one, right? And so here we are attending to something that is neutral. And if we can begin to take satisfaction in that, then that is just opening the door on the path to genuine happiness. Because we're not seeking the stimulus. We're not looking for the fix. Something to arouse, to stimulate, to make us excited. Boy, this is not exciting. And so what comes, first of all, is a sense of ease. From that comes a sense of peace, of serenity, that kind of that sweetness of flow. And then from that, as the vividness starts to come in, then it gets more and more interesting. Final point, and William James wrote so many very interesting, provocative things about attention. And one of the things he said was that when we really are able to attend to something for a sustained period of time, and it's voluntary. I mean, if you have a lot of pain, you can attend very carefully and for a long time, but it's not voluntary. But when we can direct our attention voluntarily, there's bound to be one of two reasons for that. One is that what we're attending to is interesting. Maybe you like the Harry Potter movies, or maybe you enjoy the Lord of the Rings, or some other, you know, really movie you really enjoyed, and you can hardly wait to get in, and then as you're watching it, you know, maybe it's the latest James Bond, whatever it is, but something that kind of turns you on, and as soon as you get the opening scene, you're just like, you go into film samadhi. You don't want to miss anything, you know? If later you watch it on the DVD, you make sure you play back so you didn't miss any of the script, you know? And so that, you're watching that, you're being able to attend with single-pointed samadhi, for a sustained period, because it's interesting. That's it. It's interesting. It's fun. It gives you some pleasure. So that's one way we attend. Eating a delicious banana split. Well, I can get into real samadhi on that, because every mouthful tastes really good. So that's one way, obvious. But there's another type of attention. The first one didn't need any insight at all. This one, a bit more insight. And that is some things we may attend to, not because of the intrinsic interesting factor or appealing factor of that which we're explicitly attending to, but we're attending to it because of something in the background, a larger picture. Imagine, for example, that you have a very strong motivation to be of great service as a medical doctor. You see how much physical suffering, mental suffering also. And with that motivation, you just have a great passion to become a well-trained doctor, an experienced doctor, and really be able to do good in the world. And I'm sure many, many people have had that motivation. But from what I understand, getting a medical degree, it's not a lot of fun. Just one page turner after another. One fascinating thing to learn about physiology and anatomy and to learn all the types of drugs and all of their benefits and all the side effects. And I'm sure there's just a lot of stuff that just can't be that interesting when you're going through 4, 5, 6 years of medical training. But if you have a very strong motivation, then your attention will be there. Maybe you'd like to score really high on, you know, at Harvard Medical School, Stanford Medical School, UC San Francisco. You'd like to get really, you know, top of the class. So from there, you can go into a really good hospital or clinic. And maybe it's still altruism as your motivation. Then I can do more good, rather than kind of doing poorly in school and then just winding up in some little mediocre clinic. And so there are all types of motivation. Often it's just the striving to excel. Maybe it's competitive, could be. So you're dredging through these pages and pages of stuff you have to memorize verbatim, otherwise you won't pass your exams, but you do it. The attention remains there. And bear in mind, mindfulness also means memory, recollection. You're reading, you're attending closely, remembering, and then you take your exams and you score high marks on your exams. And then hopefully you go off and be a really good doctor. Well, it wasn't because the material was interesting, but because of the background motivation and the bigger picture. What's this all about? So here's something, the sensations of the breath, about as interesting as the anatomy of the inside of the intestines. You know, I mean, I guess somebody must be interested in that, but I'm not one of them. But if you have the bigger picture, why doing this? What's the point? What's the bigger picture? What's the bigger picture? What's the bigger picture? Oh boy. Okay, back to the breath. And that's how you arouse inspiration. And you can really focus for a sustained period because you have the big picture. Now, when you're doing the practice, you're not thinking about all those other things. Then it said, Gunung Gizimba. Your meditation is held by your motivation. It's sustained. It's sustained by the motivation. That is the bigger picture. Why are you doing this? Renunciation, bodhicitta, the benefits of shamatha, benefits of bodhicitta, and so forth. You're not thinking about those things when you're doing the practice. But nevertheless, it's an undercurrent. It's what's holding you, giving you the inspiration, enthusiasm. It's there in the background. You have it explicit before the session. You may have it explicit after the session when you're dedicating merit. But during the session, it goes quiet. And then just doing the practice. Okay? Lasso.